You kind of caught me off guard there, Richard. I don't know what, I know Randy invited you on, but I don't know what topics he wanted to discuss. So while we're waiting for Randy to chime in, why don't you give us a little background on who.
Okay. Well, I can, I don't like the Energizer Bunny. You just, wind me up and watch me go. Back in the early days, I'd say it was good to, have me start in the morning and face west. That way, when the sun went down, I knew it was time to quit. But we're well after sundown. I have no means to know who your audience, what knowledge they may have of what I came to call the Secrets of the Legal Industry Project.
But Richard, this is Randy Kelton. I'm back up. We have a very sophisticated audience.
Okay.
So the biggest mistake I have made with my audience is not trusting their depth of knowledge.
Okay.
So
that's
I
great.
Wouldn't, don't be bashful about taking our audience on.
Okay. All right. Is there a particular topic area that you'd like to hear me expand what I know on?
Well, I would kind of like to go over the basics. Someone who gets accused of a crime or gets sued and has no idea what's coming at him, what are the basics a person should know when they walk in the door?
Well, actually, that's a great place to start. And as I began to teach to groups way back in 2001, you want to make sure that you do not overcomplicate what you're involved in. That's the lawyer's job, is to complicate it, make it confusing. And so over the years, we developed what we refer to as a mantra. And when I say we, Marie, of course, joined the project back about 6 years ago, and we've had other teachers. The focus has always been to be teacher coaches, to get people to be proactive. And you got to start with a baseline, and here it is. I don't care what the issue is, whether it's criminal, whether it's civil, quasi-criminal, or whether it's administrative, whether it's a tax issue, foreclosure, whatever it is, we like to get people to subscribe to what we've called the mantra of the Helm Society School. You have a known, you have a legal jeopardy when there is a known duty, the breach of which has caused the breach of which has caused damages, as attested to by at least one competent fact witness testifying under oath, subject to cross-examination regarding authenticated evidence. In other words, it doesn't matter what it is. We've got to know who did what, where did they do it, when did they do it, how did they do it, what law was violated, who is the victim, and what are the damages. So it's a known duty, the breach of which is the causation of damages, as attested to by one competent fact witness testifying under oath, subject to cross-examination, regarding authenticated evidence. That's it. That's all you fundamentally need to know about your approach to any legal problem from any angle. And having studied this situation now for actually coming up on 28 years, what I've seen is a consistent fallacy in what I refer to as the legal industry. There's never any competent fact witness. So it doesn't matter what the circumstance is. The question is always one from their perspective of morality. They always equate you, their target, as a bad person. You did something bad. You didn't pay your fair share of taxes. You're trying to cheat my client. You didn't make your mortgage payments. So that's fine. They try to reduce you psychologically to the behavior of a child, and they want you to make you feel bad. I am a bad child. And so the first obstacle that people need to overcome is law has nothing to do with morality. Law is about one thing and one thing only, duty. Tell me the duty that I breached. And so you have to begin that with that fundamental baseline to keep them from casting you in a false morality. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Yes. Yeah.
We are experiencing some technical difficulty, Richard. I do apologize. We're trying to get it worked out on the background, but I believe we're going through. Go ahead. It does make sense.
Okay. All right. So this is what I began to teach people way back in 2001 when I had seminars. And I wanted to start with something simple so that I could give people a project with the attitude of winning. Because people have to believe that they can go to court and actually win. And so the main focus was on teaching people how to beat a lawsuit for credit card collection. Now, there's a lot of angles to what that whole venue is about, but you basically challenge them because we know it's a big racket. Credit card collection is a big racket. Lawyers buy credit card charge-offs, and then they sue you because you're a bad person. The way to stop this racket is to say, well, wait a minute. I don't know that I have a duty to your client. Can you prove that? Well, you have a credit card with Visa. I do. Well, you don't? Well, no, wait a minute. Now, let's get something straight here. You have the burden of proof, and I need to know why you think you should sue me. Well, you had a Visa card, you ran up a big debt, you didn't pay it off, and now you're being sued for collection. Okay? I still don't understand why I'm here. I need to know what this is about. Same way with taxes, same way with mortgage foreclosure, same way with almost everything. Get the focus on, I need to know what this is about. Well, you didn't make your mortgage payment, and so we're going to take your house. You're going to do what? Well, you didn't make your mortgage payment. You have to make your mortgage payments. I don't know what a mortgage payment is. You don't? No. No, where's the contract that I signed obligating me to make payments? Well, right here is a copy of the mortgage. Well, to me, that looks like that has something to do with my house. But I need to see a copy of the contract that I signed agreeing to make payments. Now, let's start with that. Show me where I agreed to make payments. And all of a sudden, the entire focus of everything that has anything to do with law shifts because we're getting back to the equation. I might be a bad person. That's not what this is about. I need to know what duty I've breached. Show me where I breached the duty. Saying, well, you didn't pay your fair share of taxes. Well, you know, I feel awfully bad if I didn't do something I should have done. But what was the statute that imposed a duty on me to pay taxes? Can you tell me that? That's where I need to start because I just don't really understand what you want with me.
And that's where it all tends to fly apart, isn't it?
Yeah, and this is that thing they tend to talk about called foundation.
Mm-hmm.
You make this assertion, and I want to see some foundation.
Show me the law. Show me the article in the contract. Show me something.
Yeah, show me something that imposed a duty on me that I breached. And who says that I breached that duty?
Stay right there, Richard. We got a break coming up. 512-646-1984 is the number to dial, folks, and we will be right back after these brief messages. Stay tuned.
It's a never-ending circle with me. but and not to insult the intelligence of any of your listeners, because I've already been informed that they're a very astute group, and I really appreciate that. But to get back and state where I have been teaching for many years now, I had to put things in a simplified format, and I had to teach people what I called the secrets of the legal industry. And one of the really astounding secrets of the legal industry is probably your listeners know, but most people don't know. In fact, most lawyers don't know, and even most judges don't know, is the definition of subject matter jurisdiction. You don't get anywhere in any type of proceeding until you establish that the forum has subject matter jurisdiction. So what's a concise definition of subject matter jurisdiction? Subject matter jurisdiction is the statute, the contract, or the common law authority that establishes a duty. It imposes a duty on someone to do something. But that's only one half of subject matter jurisdiction. The other half of subject matter jurisdiction is the factual sufficiency of a claim. In other words, a victim states that they have damages in fact because you breached that duty. Now, to me, that's the simplest thing in the world, but courts typically have absolutely nothing to do with subject matter jurisdiction. It's a matter of some lawyer saying that you're a bad person, the judge agrees, he gives them a rubber stamp, and now you've lost your money, your property, or your liberty. So I began many years ago teaching people to hold up a stop sign and say, wait a minute, we need to establish the subject matter jurisdiction of this court. Well, back in the early days, very few people had ever heard of subject matter jurisdiction. They thought, well, if they get service on you, they've got jurisdiction over you. Well, that's in personam jurisdiction. The most important thing to understand is they have to have subject matter jurisdiction. There has to be some evidence that you had a duty and that you breached that duty and it resulted in damages, and somebody has testified to those damages. Now, putting in the context of a mortgage foreclosure, for example, people are sued by the thousands every day for mortgage foreclosure. So they get service on the person. The lawyer runs into court, confers with his buddy, the judge, and says, well, Randy's a bad person. He didn't make his mortgage payments. Oh, he's trying to get a house for free. He's one of those rascals. Well, I'll just give you a judgment. You go take his house right now. And alarmingly, this has only happened maybe about 5 to 10 million times.
Yeah, that's consistent from the bench.
So the thing that I had to teach people to do was not complicated. Go in, answer in court, and say, well, wait a minute. This court does not have subject matter jurisdiction. Well, where'd you get that nonsense? Well, this court doesn't have subject matter jurisdiction because this court has not shown the contract that imposed a duty on me to make payments on that contract, and it has not been established that the contract for debt matches the mortgage contract. So you don't have the raise, you don't have the REM, and you don't have anybody here to testify that I didn't make the payments. Well, did you make the payments? Well, excuse me, I don't think I have the burden of proof.
Richard, for the benefit of the listeners who don't know, define res and rem.
Res is the thing that the idea of the case. What is this idea that we're talking about? The rem is the hard currency of the case. So, in other words, the res defines what imposed the duty. That's what it's about. The rem is how that duty is going to be satisfied in judgment.
Perfect.
So we just have these incredible tools that we're not using. And so my mission has always been to be an educator and a coach to teach people the intricacies, the secrets of the legal industry. And right now, there's an incredible opportunity with the area of mortgage foreclosure. And I don't care if it's mortgage foreclosure that happened 10 years ago. I don't care if it's a deed of trust in a non-judicial foreclosure state. People are being robbed, and it's a racket. Why is it a racket? Because they're collecting a false debt. Who is they? The banks? Big bad banks? No bank ever foreclosed on anybody. It takes lawyers and judges to foreclose. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that are scamming the people.
Now, yes, that's a subject matter jurisdiction is absolutely the best place to go first, because that one is the one that puts the judge in the line of fire.
Mm-hmm. Well, once raised, it's got to be proven.
Yeah, let me expand on that, and let's understand why. There are two incredibly valuable federal statutes that relate to racketeering, 18 U.S.C. 1961 and 1962. Now, when we're talking about mortgage foreclosures, we're not talking about the collection of an unlawful debt. We're talking about a false debt. Attempting to collect a false debt for a principal. So, you have two contracts when you purchase property on a mortgage. You've got the promissory note, you've got the mortgage contract. As far as what they have at the courthouse, if it's a judicial foreclosure state, they're going to have the mortgage lien, which most people think is on their property. No. A mortgage lien is not a lien on your property. A mortgage lien is a lien on the promissory note. And a similar apparatus
right.
works.
The property is just held in collateral.
It is the rem to extinguish the debt. Now, here's why this is so important. Once the promissory note and the mortgage lien or the deed of trust, once those two documents become separate as to the parties, it's no longer a secured debt. Okay, so why is that significant? Can they still collect on a promissory note? Yes, if they have one. If they have that original promissory note, they can still collect, but they cannot take the property. If they want the property, they've got to file a judgment lien. It has to go to a licensed bonded debt collector, and they have to post a double bond. If they do all that, now they can come take the property, because it's not the rem that matches the raise. It is simply property that you own that can be taken in satisfaction of judgment. However, protected by homestead, so it can't be taken. So every time you have XYZ holding mortgage-backed securities, blah, 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 as a certificate holder coming and suing you, that's fraud number one. But when they're saying, well, we're suing you because you have a mortgage with Bank of America, okay, that's fraud number two, because that became an unsecured debt once the original promissory note became separated from the mortgage contract. So every time they take
property. Okay, hang on, Richard. We're about to go to break. The Richard Cornforth.
The Richard Cornforth.
Is there more than one?
I don't know. But that's why he's the Richard.
There could be, but if there are,
there's only one of substance.
The others don't matter.
This is the one.
There you go. Before we get back in, folks, we've got a full board of callers. And if you're calling to listen, please go to Rule of Law Radio or Logos Radio and stream the line. And if you're on the line to ask questions or tell us just how ugly we are, stay there. Richard?
Right. Yeah, so when we're building our blocks of knowledge of the legal industry, of course, we want to start with a foundation of subject matter jurisdiction. And to reiterate, I define that as the contract, the statute, or the common law authority that imposed the duty on us, and the factual sufficiency of a claim that we actually breached that duty and it resulted in damages to someone. And, of course, we flip that over when we're going after them. So building block number one is subject matter jurisdiction. A second building block is a fundamental understanding of money that is very important anytime we're talking about a credit card debt or a mortgage. And in particular, we have missed an incredible opportunity historically by not understanding money. Economics is not taught in public schools, not really taught in colleges. You can find people that are PhD scientists and they don't have a clue about economics, which happens to be a favorite subject of mine. And again, I'm hoping I'm not insulting too many of your readers. But when we're talking about mortgage foreclosure, which is our best opportunity right now to really change the world, we need to understand that there are actually three forms of money. There's M1, M2, and M3. Now, I've talked to some pretty intelligent people that stare at me with a blank look because they've never heard of M1, M2, and M3. So M1 is cash and money in demand accounts, such as a checking account. M2 is money in a timed account or in some form of account that has restrictions as far as access to the money in that account. And M3 is everything else that can be conceivably used in a transaction to exchange for M1 or other M3.
So, such as another type of negotiable instrument?
Yes, absolutely. So we're talking about the mortgage foreclosure. What form of money is the mortgage contract? It's not money. Okay, what form of money is the promissory note? It is M3. A procedurally proper loan based on a promissory note and mortgage, you're doing an M3 exchange for M1. Now, historically, the source of the M1 was M2, but with the savings and loan scandal, and that's a whole long story, we know we're getting M1, but we don't know what the ultimate source of that M1 is. Now, the important thing to remember is we only have a duty to the source of that M1. And if that M1 is a mortgage investor, the only thing that can evidence a duty to that mortgage investor is a promissory note where the mortgage investor is the endorser or the actual lender, and we are the maker or the borrower. And so there's this great big oops that the legal industry, the banking industry, and the federal government thought that nobody would ever figure out that when people went into ABC Bank and signed a promissory note with ABC Bank, and ABC Bank, through one of several mechanisms, actually got a mortgage investor to fund that loan, you are no longer doing business with the bank. You were doing business with a mortgage investor. But unless the banker had the integrity to say, Randy, got somebody to make your home loan, we brokered it with Wang Lang Fu of China, and he is going to loan you this money. Here's the new promissory note. We're tearing up the old one. So your mortgage is going to obligate you to forfeit your home to this person if you don't pay on this promissory note. Do you comprehend the magnitude of the problem, otherwise known as mortgage servicing fraud. You've got $13 trillion worth of mortgages where there is no bona fide note. None. Hello? Am I still on?
Yeah, you're still on.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah.
We're just back here quiet listening and learning.
This is the most incredible thing financially that has ever happened in the world. That banks under pressure from the federal government actually went into the scheme. It was the greatest money-making deal that there was ever going to be. Get all the judges to invest in mortgage-backed securities. Get everybody, these billionaires, get them to buy into these mortgage-backed securities. Greatest investment that you could ever get involved in. Until this guy named Cornforth comes along and says, wait a minute. I can't make payments on my mortgage. Well, of course you can. That's why they're called mortgage payments. Yeah, but see, that's a generic term. I can only make payments on my promissory note that I signed with you guys. Where is it? Wow. Enormous, incredible problem. The real problem in legal parlance is failure of specific performance. Because that bank did not perform on that loan. A mortgage investor did. If you don't have a contract with the mortgage investor, all the paperwork means is that it's memorializing an attempt to get a loan for you. But unless the original promissory note that you filed, that you signed as the maker of the loan with the banker as the endorser, is not traded out for a new promissory note with the mortgage investor taking the position of the endorser, there is no evidence of your having to pay anything. They just kissed off $13 trillion of loans by doing that because they didn't think that Joe Sixpack and Sally Soccer Mom would ever have the brass to walk in and stand in front of a judge and say, don't take my house away from me. Well, you didn't make
the mortgage. There's a maxim that says never underestimate your opponent.
Right.
I think the banks have seriously, and the legal community at large has seriously underestimated the capabilities of the general public here in the United States.
I learned that lesson in Vietnam when a 4'2" karate instructor lifted me off my feet with the heel of his foot and the end of my nose.
Wow. And in the not too distant future, I want you guys to have Marie, my beloved Marie Luke, who has written probably the most fantastic mortgage foreclosure protection book in existence. And that's available on our website at richardcornforth.com. And you can subscribe to a package that has all sorts of pleadings, including winning pleadings, where people have actually...
Hold on, Richard. We're about out of time. Randy Kelton, Debra Stevens, Rule of Law Radio. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Rule of Law Radio, folks, and we're speaking with Richard Cornforth. Now, Richard, before we went to break, you were the name Marie Luke. Tell us more about Marie.
Well, I taught her everything that I knew, and she expanded on that, and she has written probably the most comprehensive book on protecting yourself from foreclosure fraud. And it comes in a package, if you want to subscribe to the full package, that gives you a lot of pleadings. This stuff is actually won for some people. Just need a lot more people to use it. It's available by visiting our website, which is richardcornforth.com. But
what's the name of the book?
The name of the book is, Marie, get on the name of your book.
Fighting Foreclosure from Fraud and Racket to Recovery.
You like that?
I like that. Hello, Marie.
Yeah.
Hello, right. Marie. I have to tell you, I had one of your admirers on the phone today. A little short guy, Jeff Sedgwick out of Maryland.
Jeff Sedgwick, yeah.
He didn't have much to say about Richard, but he had a lot to say about you.
Well, he's one of our favorite and honored people, and he's somebody that woke up one morning and say, wait a minute, I can lose and I can fight. If I fight, I might still lose, but if I don't fight, I will lose. So why not fight? And
I've known Jeff for a long time and hold him in high regard.
Right. But I was discoursing on the fact that there was a $13 trillion problem because of the little game that they played as far as not trading out the promissory note. They were merely brokering a loan, and they brokered it with somebody that you don't have a contract with. That is a part of the secrets of why there's the disappearing note aspect. But the other thing that to me, it has what I call wow factor, is what are we really, really talking about when we talk about this incredible mortgage foreclosure problem? Well, we're talking really about two things. One is the opportunity of the American people, without being terribly sophisticated, without playing Perry Mason, to engage in the greatest shift in material wealth in the history of the world, shifting all the wealth away from government and the bankers and the lawyers and the judges to them, where they achieve something that is as close as you can get to actual sovereignty. Now, that's one half of it. The other half of it is the reading and researching that I've done suggests that the economists that run the government, as far as the monetary aspect, decided that sometime back in the early 50s that the only way that you can have a prosperous economy without depressions is you've got to continually keep the economy expanding under a mantle of debt. Now, what seemed like a great idea by the brilliant minds back then really got way, way out of control. That's another story. That's not the point I'm trying to make. This government, as everybody knows, spends way too much money, and it borrows something, I've seen figures as high as 41%, of every dollar spent had to be borrowed. Who do they borrow it from? Well, it doesn't really matter because you can't carry that kind of a debt load. It's just dangerous. But how did they get countries, investors, to loan us some money? Well, how do they loan money? Well, they buy our treasury securities. Well, who wants to put $1 billion into a treasury security for 1%. Well, somebody that wants access to our markets, but also somebody who got in on this really sweetheart deal of buying into a whole bunch of mortgage-backed securities. So what was once the people's problem is rapidly shifting to be a government problem, with the exposure of the fraud of the mortgage-backed security. And I was one of the first, perhaps the very first, going back to August of 2002, that originally published the information that led to the exposure of the mortgage-backed security as a fraud. They're still trying to sort that out. But the really big problem, as far as your government sees it, is, oh, wait a minute. What are we going to do now? How are we going to rob the people so that the investors who invested in the mortgage-backed securities will continue to loan us money? Incredible problem. And if you want, I'm ready to take a few questions.
Very good. Okay. Let's go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. You go ahead. You got the board up?
I do.
You want okay. To... I'll butt okay. out.
Let's go to Reed in Illinois. Hello, Reed. What do you got for us tonight?
Hi, Richard Cornforth. I really appreciate all your materials. I've got a bunch of them.
Good.
I do. And it is good. But I've got a couple of questions. One about subject matter jurisdiction in the state of Illinois. But my first question is, I need a bit of information or advice or information, if you have it, on challenging jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction, of a state court where there was no...
Hold on, Reed. Are you on a wireless phone or headset?
I was on my speaker. I can pop off if you like.
Okay, I'm getting a peculiar beep that I normally get when you have a wireless headset, wireless phone, or a Bluetooth.
I don't have any idea what that is. I don't hear anything.
Oh, okay. You get a 10-year-old. They can explain all that stuff to you. Okay, go ahead.
Well, try to give you the short version. There was a landlord-tenant issue a few months back where the landlord found out about me and my roommate and our ongoings with being pro se litigants. So they decided to oust us by getting a default judgment using sewer service. They had someone pretend to service. We challenged that several times. Ultimately, there was an eviction in the matter.
Wow.
Went back in for motion to reconsider. And I wasn't named as a party in that particular case. However, I was directly affected, and I was the one that the process server alleged to have served, which I was at a hospital on the day and the time. But this
Reed, was let me ask, was this a mortgage or a lease or a rental agreement?
The rental agreement.
Okay.
Well, my question is a bit specific because what I'm concerned about is bringing this into district court under FDCPA, RICO, things like this. Because we had challenged the jurisdiction, and the court, the Illinois court, decided that the service was proper, even though it clearly wasn't. Well, I'm wondering about running up against res judicata, because that's already been determined by the Illinois courts.
Well, the doctrine is not res judicata. The doctrine is claim preclusion or estoppel. But let me change your focus just a little bit, because here's what I'm hearing. If I distill what I've heard you say, is you got shafted because somebody didn't like you.
All the way.
All right. Do you have access to any resource like Versus Law, for example? I'm not promoting them, but they're just happen to be a low-cost resource.
Yeah, I do. I use Versus all the time. I used to use Lexus through my school account, but I use Versus.
Stop me if you've heard this one. Breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
Okay.
In state courts, not federal courts, because remember, federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction. They're statutory courts. They're big on common law, but common law has to come under the mantle of statute. So when you're talking about state courts, I think you'll find that there is a fairly robust body of common law. And remember, when I started this conversation, if you were back here about 50 minutes ago, I said duty arises from contract, statute, or the common law. when we're talking about duty arising under the common law, we are strictly talking about states' causes of action. But I think you'll find a robust body of litigation under the heading of breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Anytime, see, everybody in their business dealings with everybody else has a higher duty not to conduct themselves in a manner that's fundamentally unfair.
Reed, you have the floor, sir.
Well, I was listening to Richard talk about the breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
Yes.
Wonderful.
And was looking into it over the break. You know, obviously it's going to take me a little more time than a five-minute break to find out more about this. But do you feel, Richard, that there is some claim preclusion to challenging this in district court anyway, shape or form?
Well, Richard, let's go a little further down this rabbit hole.
All right. Well, of course, the materials that can be helpful in this area are found at richardcornforth.com. We've got materials on fundamental law, civil procedure. Marie has written an excellent book on evidence. And if you understand that foundation, now let me go back and directly address what seems to be Reed's concern. Now, if you have raised the same issue before, then it can be, claim preclusion can come into play under collateral estoppel. But have you ever been in a court proceeding against this landlord for this specific action that offended you?
That's just it. In this case, it was my roommate that was the named defendant. I was never named, but I was named as the person who was served under a abode service here in Illinois, constructive service, that I was a person at the abode.
No, Reed, pardon me for interrupting you.
Sure.
Did you suffer a damage relative to an act by a landlord?
Yes.
Did the other person suffer a damage?
Yes.
Okay. Let's forget about the service. Let's talk about the mean and nasty thing that they did. That's where your cause of action lies. It is a tort, in other words, a personal injury, and it is governed by the statute of limitations for personal injury cases, which I'm going to say is probably going to be 2 years, possibly 3 years. How long ago did this happen?
Oh, this all happened in November of 2013. So we're still there.
Okay, so you're still there. What I would do is I would look up several cases on breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, the implied covenant and fair dealing. And if this person made your life miserable, you ought to yourself to give them a little misery. See, because there's two prisons. There's the prison that's stone walls and iron bars. And there's the prison in the mind where somebody harms you. And you are forced into a prison in your mind having to think about them harming you. And you either have to get into some deep concentration and find it within yourself to forgive that person, or if you feel like that person needs their own lesson and the damages are just too significant, then you enter a different karma, if you will. And I don't mean to make a religious comment of any kind, but sue them. Anything else?
Well, no, I mean, that's it. I did have a question about subject matter jurisdiction in Illinois, but I know you've got other calls.
No, go ahead and
wait,
if we can.
Wait, hold on a second, Reed. Let me make a suggestion. Are you familiar with any litigation guides for Illinois?
I've got lots of books on this subject ever since I found...
This is something real specific. Call a local lawyer and ask them what are the primary litigation guides used in Illinois. And Texas, we have O'Connor's, and it is absolutely wonderful. In O'Connor's, you can get O'Connor's Causes of Action. And you can go to Tortious Interference. You can go to Breach of Contract. Everything is in there. It tells you how to address it, what all the elements are, how to plead the elements, how to defend against the elements. Everything you need to know in a really concise format. And something else it generally has are sample pleadings.
Pleadings and motions, yeah.
Templates.
Those are really important because if you make up your own pleading from scratch and the lawyer comes in and gives the judge a pleading from the local litigation guides, and he looks at that one from the litigation guides, it has all of the subject matter exactly where he expects to find it. It has all the basic case law that he expects to see. The only thing he has to look at is what's different in this particular motion or this particular pleading. And you come in there and you give him 20 cases he's never seen before. And he's going to get that case and he's going to say, "You really think I'm going to read all these 20 cases? Nah, denied." Now that may not be right. But in the real world you and I live in, it's kind of how it works. So if you can find a litigation guide, it will take a lot of the work out of this.
Yeah, there's the way it is, the way it's supposed to be, and that's the way it is.
Very good.
Okay, you had a question on subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, you know, I've seen a lot of the websites around that talk about subject matter jurisdiction, the law of voids, and I see a lot of case law coming out of Illinois prior to, I'd say, 2000, speaking about the subject. It seems in 2003 or so, the Supreme Court in Illinois addressed this subject by basically overturning or redirecting the courts, telling them that since the Illinois Constitution granted, let me get this right here, subject matter jurisdiction of all justiciable issues to all courts in Illinois, that there really isn't a challenge to subject matter jurisdiction unless you're bringing like a criminal context into a divorce court. If it's not something so off like that, if it's a court that can deal with it, then the pleadings themselves aren't at issue to grant the court subject matter jurisdiction. Subject matter jurisdiction is granted by the Illinois Constitution. And that the pleadings recorded for these decisions will not deprive the court, or they won't, you know, they won't, jurisdiction won't turn on faulty pleadings. You know, there could be an appellate issue for how the case was handled. But Illinois courts have pretty much unlimited subject matter jurisdiction over all.
Okay, wait, hold on, Reed. You're talking about something very fundamental. You're talking about something that in order to maintain a corpus juris, a secure body of law, there's no way that the Supreme Court is just going to generally grant subject matter jurisdiction. Will you address that, Rick?
Yeah. Reed, forget what they say. They're third-rate politicians. You can carve this in stone. Subject matter jurisdiction from the beginning of time, when there was such a thing as a tribunal, until 10 minutes past the end of time, is always going to be what imposed the duty and what's the factual sufficiency of a claim that the duty was breached. You got to have both of them. You absolutely have to have both of them. And so
let me give a quick example. We had a case where a credit card company sued a client, but they didn't follow the rules in filing the suit with the court. So we challenged subject matter jurisdiction. We're not saying the court doesn't have jurisdiction to rule in these kinds of matters. We're saying in this particular case, the plaintiff, in pleading his issue, failed to sufficiently invoke the subject matter jurisdiction of the court. They don't have it for some, because of some basic issue, but just because these guys didn't do their job right. In order for the court to have subject matter jurisdiction, the other party has to properly invoke it. And that's where most of the claims have come for. Does that sound right, Richard?
Yes. And it's an easy subject to labor on, but just remember, there's got to be a statute or a contract. That's one half of the coin. The other side of the coin is damages. If you don't have any damages, it doesn't matter whether the court has jurisdiction to hear a breach of contract case or not. Mm-hmm. Establishing that you have a contract with somebody does not give you the right to sue them over that breach of contract, even though the Supreme Court has said the Constitution, oh yeah, they have subject matter jurisdiction to handle a breach of contract case. Oh, really? Okay, so what are the damages?
Right.
Or, I mean, you've got a point where in that contract I had the duty that I breached. And that, see, that brings us full cycle right back to the mortgage contract. Does the mortgage contract impose a duty on you? No. The mortgage contract imposes a duty on the property conditioned on your breaching a duty under the promissory note. The promissory note is what imposed the duty on you. So, but
if I remember correctly, though, this is a rental agreement, not a mortgage agreement.
No. See, I'm just using that as an analogy.
As an example. Good deal.
But see, it doesn't matter whether you even have an agreement. The point is, are there two people that have any kind of a relationship to one another? Because if you're driving down the street and there's a red stop sign and you go through that stop sign and you strike another person's vehicle, do you have a legal jeopardy? Why? Yes. Why? Because that stop sign imposed a duty on you. You had a known duty and you breached it. Okay. Let's say that you're driving down the road and you're whistling a happy tune, thinking about all the money you made today, and there's no stop sign, and you still hit somebody. Do you have a legal jeopardy? Yes,
nope.
You can still have a legal jeopardy because of the duty to exercise reasonable care and caution, not to harm another person. Who decides the facts of the case?
Welcome back to Rule of Law, folks. And Richard, before we get started, when you're through with your questions and everything, stay on the line because Mr. Esquivel, while we were listening to everything Richard was telling you, found an Illinois litigation guide. So don't hang up at the end of the call. The call screener will bring you back up, get your email address, and email you that link. Does that sound good?
That sounds great to me.
Okay. We're here to help as best we can.
And that's what we do.
That's what we do.
Yes.
Okay.
Does anybody remember where we were at?
Yeah.
Did we have any more questions?
Closed out a conversation on subject matter jurisdiction.
Yes.
Litigation guide.
Well, that was another issue.
Right.
Subject matter jurisdiction.
Yeah, and
everybody has
a duty to act right, period. If they don't act right and they cause an injury, they can still be sued.
Under common law.
Yep, that's right. That's what the common law is for, but it's only in state court.
Okay. All right. Am I still on the air? Because I don't know if you guys are hearing me or not.
Yes, you are.
All right.
Well, okay, Reed, is that pretty well, is your question pretty well answered?
It's well answered. I really appreciate the time, guys. I know you're taking up quite a bit of time with me here.
And there may be some new materials there on richardcornforth.com for you. We've really tried to ramp it up.
All right, fair enough. I will return.
Excellent. Well, Richard, stay there. We're going to mute you on this end and go to the next caller, but don't hang up. The call screener will pull you back up and exchange that information. And thank you for calling in tonight. All right. Let's go to Kristen in Texas. Hello, Kristen. How are you this evening?
I'm good. Thank you. Richard, Kristen, I went in your class last year. Give Marie a big hug, please, for me. I have a question in regards to several points, and I won't take long. Hopefully you'll touch on them in your conversations, but I'm currently in litigation now, and it seems like my timing is off because this is my first time actually going through a full process. I know that I have to file my witness list and my Rule 26 discovery, but the courts would not allow me to file it in the court, and I'm just wondering, when do I actually file it? I mean, send it to the opposing party, and is it much different than the witness list and the evidence list that I have to file with the court? What is the timing to all of that? And since I'm asking all these questions, if you can jot these down for me real quick, can a tort claim be filed in the midst of a sham legal proceeding? And then I have another question in regards to...
Let's get these one at a time.
Yeah, let's do one. First of all, the first question is, you tried to engage discovery. Now, we have great difficulty as so-called pro se litigants, and of course, we know we're really in pro se persona, but they like to categorize us as pro se. We're ignorant rubes. We don't know anything. And the lawyers, the bar licensed attorney, tend to exploit that by just ignoring the discovery that we file.
Right.
Now, the judge or the clerk can toss out an attempt to pre-file discovery. The way to get around that, the way to make the court aware that you've done your Rule 26 disclosures, which is an incredibly powerful tool, the way to let the judge know that you are wanting to engage discovery so that you can get on down the trail, get to the ultimate facts, and get it done, is put the court on notice of a proposed discovery plan and attach your discovery to that. Now, our students are familiar with the use of declarations. You can actually put a declaration in notice to the court of I'm proposing this discovery plan, and then put a declaration in it that if you don't hear an objection from the other side, you're going to go ahead, and if they want to object and set it for hearing before the court with a discovery conference, that's fine. You're copacetic with that. But if they're not going to object, you're going to presume that it's okay for you to go ahead and engage discovery. Now, what that does is it tends to light a fire under the other side to try to agitate to do something, and they're unpredictable. But the way to get around a judge or a clerk saying, oh, no, wait a minute, you can't file your discovery here. You have to do that later on. When the judge asks for it, and when you're using it to support a summary judgment, whoa. I'm giving you notice of my proposed discovery plan. And I'm also being courteous to the opposing party, and I'm saying, now if you guys object to this, please let me know if you object to this, and let's go ahead and set it for a hearing to determine whether or not in a discovery conference to determine whether or not this is good discovery. So that, I hope, forecloses your first question. The second is, can you insert a new cause of action, a new tort in an ongoing case?
Yes. As a defendant or a plaintiff, you can add a cause of action or a party with leave of the court. So let's say that you sued somebody for a breach of contract and you discovered a cause of action for fraud and you're already on down the trail of litigation. What you do is you notice the court that you want leave to amend your pleading to include newly discovered evidence of a further cause of action. And, you know, I'm not somebody that's really truthfully going to win a lot of awards on pleading because I'm not focused on creating a perfect symphony. I'm focused on winning. And you win with logic. And you do yourself a great, great favor when you petition the court without currying favor. You're essentially saying, may I engage discovery? Here's what I want to do. Here's my plan. Please let me go forward with this. I'm noticing you that this is my proposed discovery plan. I'm noticing you that I would like leave to amend my pleading because, hey, I just discovered something that really is right within the same transaction occurrence that I have been exposed to. Does that answer your question?
Yes and no. Let me explain the midst of the sham proceedings. I had quieted my title in state court, and the opposing party moved it to federal court, obviously with no jurisdiction. And now...
Well, when you say there's no jurisdiction, was there diversity of jurisdiction? Are you in one state and the other litigant in another state?
Well, that's what they're claiming, but here's the problem. With diversity, you have to have a minimum of $75,000. And I was in administrative pleading the state court over the fact that the mortgage, well, the assignment on the registered deeds showed a $1 consideration. And so I put in my affidavit.
Wait, hold on.
Whoa. The threshold is for the, is completely different. You got them a little mixed up. And Randy, you can go into that and explain it.
Well, I wasn't going to go to the threshold. I was going to go to the Federal Court Venue and Removal Clarification Act of 2012. Changed everything.
Very limited.
They have diversity jurisdiction unless one party lives inside the state. If one party is in the state, there is no diversity. And if they're... When a case is removed, we're out of time, and we'll talk about cases being removed when we come back on the other side. This is Randy Kelton, Steve Skidmore, Joe Escovel, here with our special guest, Richard Cornforth. We'll be right back on the other side.
Before we go forward,
Christian, you're saying that you filed a suit in state court in a foreclosure case, and it was removed to the Fed. I'd like to ask you, since you're in Texas, your suit in the district court, were you raising an issue of genuine title or were you raising an issue of wrongful foreclosure? I have a reason for asking this.
I have to correct you. It was a quiet title case in Michigan. I'm actually from Michigan. I'm currently visiting Texas.
Oh, I see.
But,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so jurisdiction is in Michigan.
And they use mortgages, right, even though it's non-jurisdictional. It's administrative.
Okay.
Well, what I'm wondering is, did it involve a federal question such as predatory lending?
No, it did not. It was purely a quiet title because they did not have – actually, they filed that they owned the mortgage note in the midst of a default that had that one particular time, and that goes against statute because you can't buy a note while it's in default, and I purposely put that in there. And they want to try to twist it up and make it seem like I was in foreclosure, but I'm the one that brought the case out, and I'm not in foreclosure. And I told them, I challenged the jurisdiction, but they didn't have it because the amount of the so-called assignment was for a dollar. And so where was the $75,000 limit in order for the federal court to hear it?
Well, to me, there's another problem because so many of the foreclosures involve a federal question. But yours is just simply an invalid defeasance to title.
Right.
They crosswired it. And that absolutely, the federal court does not have subject matter jurisdiction to hear such a case.
But the proceedings has been going on for a year purposely. They know that they don't have it, but yet they keep prolonging the case.
Okay.
Churning it.
Yeah.
They're churning the case so that they can bill their client. That'll get them in trouble.
We just moved for sanctions against the lawyer and asked the court to grant sanctions against the lawyer in the amount he charged his client to file this frivolous pleading.
But here's the problem.
We won't get it, but we blacked his eye.
The judge is testifying and has testified in his orders that he won't remove himself. I asked him to disqualify himself. He won't do it. So that's why I asked, can I now file another tort case against them while we're still playing this fraudulent legal proceeding game?
Against the judge? I'd say he earned himself a judicial misconduct complaint.
In the Fed a separate pleading.
Yeah,
a separate case.
Here's what I need to understand. Are you still in constructive use of the property?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Quite.
I suggest threaten the lawyer with a combination Fair Debt Collections Practices Act suit and racketeering suit. And
I did that already, and that didn't scare him earlier in the case.
You threatened him or you filed it?
I'm about to file it, though, because my statute of limitation, which I'm glad you brought it up, can I toll it? If I'm just now becoming aware of my violations?
No. The FDCPA has a very, very bright line, 1 year statute of limitation from a known act. And
Act? When I disputed the debt, is that the known act or when I filed for a hearing with the CDP? When is it considered a known act?
It's a known act when you become aware of it.
The known act is something that they have to do. So, in other words, if you disputed it and they proceeded with litigation without resolving the dispute, that tolls the time for the act. But here's what everybody should remember. Lawyers are stupid. And if a statute of limitations has expired, with the exception of the FDCPA, you can reset it by tacit procreation. You can send a lawyer a letter, certified mail, say, dude, I want to get this done. Would you please respond to these specific facts? He either responds and resets or he doesn't respond because you put a disclaimer in there and say, look, if you don't respond within X number of days, I'm going to assume that you're in agreement that everything is resolved and you're going to leave me alone. So it is possible to reset almost any cause of action that involves a monetary transaction. The exception to that would be the FDCPA, a personal injury involving motor vehicle or something like that. You're not going to be able to reset that unless you actually have an issue of delayed discovery. But
can I make a suggestion of a slightly different tact? I no longer make claims under Hopatila RESPA. What I make a claim under is Covenant 16 of the security instrument where both parties agreed to abide by all law. Breach of contract. And that, the clock doesn't run on that one. I'd never, ever claim the remedy provided by the legislature in the FDCPA or the Truth in Lending Act. I claim a breach of Covenant 16.
How about a qualified written request?
If they don't respond to we do the qualified written request, and I see a lot of them on the internet, and most of them really aren't qualified written requests because they don't claim an accounting error.
How about a debt validation versus qualified written request?
Debt validation, they're time limits of when you can file those things. The qualified written request is a good one if you just take all of the amounts, all of the fees from the HUD-1 settlement statement and state that, you know, at closing, you didn't provide documentation to show that these fees were actually valid. That, so I believe they're all bogus. And Rodash fees is a term that comes from a California case. And that's fraudulent fees on the HUD-1. They all have them. You claim they're all fraudulent and ask the lender to correct the payment amounts by deducting the full amount from the HUD-1 settlement statement. That's your accounting error claim. And it turns, most people just send a request for discovery and call it a qualified written request. It has to have an accounting error. And you've got that one laying there in the background you can always use. Does that make sense, Richard?
Yeah, it does. I'm coming back to square one, wanting to leave Christine with a strategy. And if you have threatened them with a racketeering suit, you might blow the dust off that and just get it done. And also, if you'll check your state statutes, racketeering has comity with states. Sometimes you have to file a complaint with the state attorney general, but don't overlook a possibility, because it seems like you've run into some particularly nasty federal officials there. And once your name gets before a federal venue, favorably or unfavorably, it's a highway one way or the other. And it still amazes me that I'm blacklisted in some places where I never did anything wrong, and in other places I almost, like falling off a log, got some pretty important litigation through. But I would say maybe to try to get closure, go ahead and file the racketeering suit.
Okay.
I once had a lawyer tell me that filing a RICO suit is like dropping an atomic bomb on them. They really hate that.
Well, because they can't understand it. It's too simple for them. Look, there's only about seven elements, and you only have to hit four of them. And if you hit those, you've got them. And if they're halfway smart, they'll come to some terms. We put the second largest law firm in Oklahoma out of business, and it only took probably about 10 weeks.
Hold on, Richard. We're about to go to break. Randy Kelton, Steve Skidmore, Joe Esquivel here with our special guest, Richard Cornforth. And Richard, before we start, go back to Kristen. Will you give out your website again?
Oh,
and
my
the book
pleasure.
That Marie has written.
Yeah, the website is richardcornforth.com. The video course is now available there. You can buy videos. You can acquire books. You can get packages and materials. One of the highly featured offerings there is Marie's book and companion materials on fighting foreclosure. And it may be, I'd say it's high on the list of comprehensive information that people can get to protect themselves from foreclosure fraud and materials that actually can work. And again, that's richardcornforth.com. All kinds of stuff there.
Okay, wonderful. Now we're going to go back to Kristen in Texas.
All right.
Okay.
Okay.
Richard,
go ahead, Kristen.
Okay, thank you. Richard, you once said in one of your courses that appealing a file sometimes is like just having the clerk review it instead of the judge, and it can be a waste of time. Is it better to just file a government tort claim as opposed to appealing a file if a court lacks subject matter jurisdiction to begin with?
Well, I wouldn't bypass filing an appeal. I would still file an appeal even though the appellate process has been long adulterated. I would still go the appellate route. The problem with the tort claim is it's difficult to set up. I encourage people to do the tort claim, and when people really learn how to do a perfected strategy on a tort claim, it's going to be a real game changer. But you have to be careful on how you actually set it up. And to fundamentally set up a tort claim, you have to file a complaint against the entity that has the duty to supervise and review conduct of a public official. And they have to. They have a statutory duty to investigate, take appropriate action. And if they don't, then they're liable. And then that way you can sue them both. But if you don't pursue that administrative proceeding, you can't sue them. So it's something that is strategically, the layout is there, but I would not forego an opportunity to go to appeal either before or do both of them.
Most jurisdictions that I've seen require that before you can sue a governmental agency or a governmental entity, that you must give them a notice and opportunity and 60 days to repair.
Right.
So you have to send them a tort letter and give them 60 days. Otherwise, you can't sue at all.
Right.
It's been my experience. They never, ever respond to the tort letter. So it's just
right.
A perfunctory thing you need to do.
So let's just say that in order to do a civil rights litigation, you have 1 year to do it from the time that it occurred. And in my case, through fraudulent proceedings with my quiet title, I am approaching a year. So I won't be able to do it because it's going to, if I have to give them 60 days notice, I'm going to.
Wait a minute. Are you talking about a year from the first day they did something wrong or the last day they did something wrong?
Well, the first day that they moved it to the federal court was back in May of last year. And
if the federal court didn't have jurisdiction, everything they're doing in the federal court is adding to the wrong.
Right.
So the clock's not running yet.
Okay, good. Okay. All right.
Is that correct? Is that correct, Richard?
That is correct.
Okay. Because I have like 5 file cases that I'm doing. I have so much confidence coming out of Richard's class that I just took on the world. And it's been an eye-opening experience having to go through all of this. I just had one other question because I have not fully gone through the whole court process, so I'm kind of going at it blindly. And I don't have the experience behind me to really know what to do next. But I have a case where I filed a complaint in the FCC, Fair Debt Collection Court, and the judge has called for a teleconference. Can that be considered the same as a pretrial conference? I'm not sure how this works with my – I did send the opposing party my Rule 26 disclosure and my –
Oh, great. Great.
And also, but I didn't notice the court. I tried. Well, I didn't notice the court about it because they kept telling me I couldn't file it. So I just sent it to the opposing party. And so I don't know what the steps in the games are at this point because the judge is scheduled a teleconference on the 25th of May. I'm sorry, the 22nd of May.
That's great news. That's great news. And what I would do is consider putting the court on notice of your Rule 26 disclosures. there's a difference between filing Rule 26 disclosures and then putting on notice. There are cases that we have won in this conference, and there was one in particular that comes to mind where my student, it was actually a face-to-face conference, but the judge called for the conference, and my student had done the Rule 26, and the other side had not, and so went before the judge, and of course the judges, they don't want to mess around with this stuff. They're busy. They want the really big stuff. Federal judges are second-rate politicians. And so my guy says, I don't know how we can have a trial. What do you mean? Well, they didn't give me their Rule 26 discovery disclosures, and because they didn't, I don't know what I can engage discovery on, and so we're going to come up to a trial, and they're not going to have anything to use in trial because they didn't tell me what they were disclosing that could be an area of discovery. Judge says, well, that's right. What do you, why didn't you do that? In other words, berated the lawyer and slammed him with a judgment of a couple thousand bucks, which that on the surface doesn't sound like very much, but he beat the lawyer. And if we could get 1,000 people a week to file an FDCPA, how much is 1,000 times 1,000? We could be taking $1 million a week from lawyers that are just harassing us. And if they actually get money or go ahead.
I have a friend that said the judge tore the button off the lawyer's shirt.
Well, see, you're talking about some guy that makes $256,000 a year looking at a lawyer that is probably starving to death, taking on people, harassing them, telling a pack of lies. He just has no respect for him at all. And so the FDCPA is still one of our best strategies. And, of course, if they do actually cause you damages, you can get those damages through the FDCPA now. You not only get your statutory and your inconvenience, but how much did they take from you? Well, you get that now, too.
Amen. Amen. And one quick question, because you guys have been so patient with me. I appreciate that. I have another FDCPA.
Kristen, hold on one question.
Okay.
What do you have you had a scheduling conference?
See, I'm not. I hear these terms and I read it, and I'm
okay.
Kind of
okay. Let me explain this. Contact the lawyer on the other side and ask him for a proposed scheduling conference. How long is it going to take you for discovery? You notice all your witnesses, all of the time frames of everything that's supposed to happen. Ask the other side to send you a proposed scheduling order. You have to do this at least a week before the scheduling conference. And if he asks for a phone conference, that's most likely what that is. So call the lawyer, ask him to send you a proposed scheduling conference, and you look at it and add a month to all the dates and send it back. And then you're ready for the scheduling conference. Is this the first thing the judge has... The first time the court has actually had you do something?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, it's almost always a scheduling conference. It's non-confrontation.
Okay.
Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, and actually, you're right, it usually is non-confrontational, but it's not unusual for one of two things to happen. One thing that can happen is the judge can push back and say, I tell you what, let's go behind the pleadings. You have something that's pretty important to you to bring to this court. Can you just kind of tell me a little story? Depending on the person, that can be a great opportunity. Sure. The other thing that is not uncommon to come out of such a conference is the judge to kind of pull his ears and say, what I want you guys to do is meet with Magistrate Jones over here. We can set that up in a couple of weeks. And I just want you to see if you can just both work that out. And federal judges look at a lawyer that is uncooperative with extreme disfavor. And so there's all kinds of possibilities. That's kind of one that you pray over, because there could be some really interesting results come out of that. Particularly if you get your opportunity to tell a story and you say, I'm being harassed. I don't even know what all the angles of why this person is acting this way and doing these things, but I want them to leave me alone.
Amen.
Okay, wait, hang on. We're about to go to break. Okay, we are back. Randy Kelton, Steve Skidmore, Joe Esquivel, here with our special guest, Richard Cornforth, and Marie Lupe. Is it Lupe or Loop?
Marie Cornforth.
Oh, Cornforth. Okay. He didn't tell us that part. We thought you were his girlfriend. Okay. Yeah. We're always joking here. Kristen, I think you know Marie.
Yes, I do.
Hi,
and
Kristen.
You had one more question?
Yeah,
go ahead, Marie.
One more question. Hey, girl.
You had one more question, and Marie was going to field that one for us.
Oh, okay, real good. Hey, Marie, you've been such great help for me. I am in a FDCP hearing that I filed for my mom. I threw myself on there because I claimed that my mother needed financial support, and she was misled by the false statements in the mail and needed the financial help, so that's where I came in, which is true. And they're trying to throw it out. And I didn't get a chance to file my witness list with the court and whatnot. What is my strategy for that? I mean, I'm still going, they filed for a motion to dismiss, and I'm going to strike that. It's not too late for me to file my witness list, is it?
Oh, absolutely not. And I don't know how far along. I know we've discussed this and we've contacted each other. And I'm not sure where you are right this minute, but you can go as far as if you even took it to trial. Of course, at pretrial, you would list your witnesses and whatever material they were going to testify to, along with your opposing party would do the same thing. So you could list your witnesses anytime.
But here's the thing. How can I even make it to trial when they won't even put together an affidavit? They're doing this all based on an attorney's statement. As we all know, the attorney cannot testify.
Right.
Shouldn't it just be this? Shouldn't we just win because they're not disclosing the party?
Well, should and can are, of course, different from what the statutes are. Anytime a judge or a lawyer can convince you of the can rules or the threatening rules, they will. But if you can just hold them right up to the candle and ask what statute is being broken and who the damaged party is, then that would be supportive to you.
Okay.
And as far as the affidavit, Kristen, it's very difficult to even look at any affidavits because, of course, as we know, affidavits, you have to have personal knowledge of the fact to be able to testify. And personal knowledge would have to be during the time of business and at the time either conception of the complaint. But the point is an affidavit is never beliefs, it's never opinions, it's never, this is the business practice. An affidavit is personal knowledge bolstered by any statement or receipt that will back up what the fact is that you're testifying to in your affidavit.
Okay. Well, right, I know that for me, because I'm the one I'm the plaintiff in this situation. They're coming with no affidavit, and it's all based on, and no certified documents. They put a whole pile of attachments to their answer, and it's not been certified, and they have no personal knowledge affidavit testimony to any of that stuff. So
right. And another point is I'm working on a high-profile appeal right now, and the point is, and to all you listeners out there, or I don't know if we're on the air, but of course the recorded original note, and the inseparable mortgage with your name on it and the person you've made that contract with has to be attached at the inception of the complaint. So when the complaint is filed, all this has to be attached. If not, it's void and null.
What about blank endorsements?
No.
Incomplete stampings rather than a blank endorsement. You need to go to 3205 of the Uniform Commercial Code, and that'll help you.
And
sorry to interrupt
commercial
you.
Code, since you brought it up, of course, code is code. Statute is statute. Code is not a statute, but code has to plead in harmony with the statute to be legal.
Okay. Man, thank you guys so much. I appreciate this, and I praise God for the wisdom that's been given. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, and we just appreciate you, and we like being servants. And that's what Richard and I, we consider ourselves servants for those that are really our need. And we just hope that you'll visit our website and anything there that, as far as our materials, we hope they will be helpful for you.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Kristen.
Thank you.
Now we're going to go to Ed in Louisiana. Hello, Mr. Ed. What do you have for us?
Hello. Hello, Richard and Marie.
Hey, Ed. How are you doing?
Guys, again, I'm doing fine.
Good.
Of course, I've got probably the strangest relationship with my bank. My basic question is, can I do a qualified request if I'm, quote-unquote, behind on my payments?
Oh, absolutely. And if you do write a qualified written request letter,
mm-hmm.
And you don't get a response, write the second one. And again, if you need a sample or a template for that, please visit us at richardcornforth.com. And our email address for the website is lawclubusa@yahoo.com. And, Ed, we've discussed the qualified written request before, and I'm not sure where you are on that. I know that you've been exercising that as a privilege to use. And we've used that several times with other students, and we're at the point now of collateral attacking these mortgage servicers for cognitive and punitive damages.
Right. I haven't been able to move on it the way I wanted to because I've had, you know, issues with my personal life that have, you know, when your health and your, illness, is more important than legal matters. But if I can prove that they committed fraud, what happened was they foreclosed on me, or they tried to, and they went all the way put the notice of sheriff's sale, so I knuckled under, and because I had other issues, I went and recovered or repaired or whatever they call it, paid the balance, and I was caught up. And then inexplicably, 2 months later, all of the attorney's fees and interest and penalties were just refunded to my account without explanation. It was like 3-4 months worth of mortgage payments.
Right. And, of course, I know you followed up with the dispute letters, and we've got one student similar to this situation where all kinds of fees were added in, even to the point of taking pictures and appraising. But what we teach is just dispute it with the dispute letters, and we've got one student that is on their 27th dispute letter.
So So I should even dispute an accounting in my favor?
Oh, absolutely. Because, first of all, they'd have to come up with the material as far as the original promissory note and the mortgage with your name on it and theirs. And even if they came up to a suit with you, they would have to attach that at the inception of the complaint.
Okay. I see.
A point about them, an accounting error in your favor. These guys are scoundrels.
Well, if you check the latest, and it's in my foreclosure book, is the 49 attorney generals of the United States sued the big banks and against mortgage servicing fraud and won. And, of course, that's why most of the people have been getting their settlements from that suit. So mortgage servicing fraud has been a long time. And if you go to mortgage servicing fraud, Google it, you probably find over 150 service frauds that probably most of you will find in your own paperwork. So if you want to use that United States case, I have that in the foreclosure book, so it might be helpful.
Yes, and watch these guys, because if they gave that money back to you, what they're likely to do is watch your payments. And the third time you're slow to pay, then they're going to presume that you're struggling. And then they're going to come back and say, "Oy vey, oh, we made a mistake. We gave all this money back to you and we shouldn't have. So we've been charging interest on it all this time. Pay us 10 grand or we're going to foreclose tomorrow."
Good.
Right. And at that point, you just go ahead and countersue them for more than what they're suing you for.
Right. I found out by accident that I discovered the fraud, because when I had heard from, I'd gotten a letter from some lawyer, "Oh, yes, you're under foreclosure." "Really?" And I hadn't been noticed yet. So I went to the court and I got the paperwork, and they had, you know, like 6 pages of documents. And then later I went back, a couple of months later, after I was still fighting with them, and they had added paperwork. And in February of 2013, the servicer, quote unquote, bought the mortgage from MERS, even though they had maintained that they were the owner of the mortgage they'd been trying to collect from me for 14 months prior to that.
So, okay. And of course, that's in the foreclosure book too. MERS is not ownership to anything. MERS is just an electronic system that holds a numbering system. And I have that case also where they admitted that they didn't have anything. And MERS is a system. It's a business. And because they electronically file for these banks, they have memberships that people buy into, like law firms, and they'll buy bundles of these numbers, and they'll call it, they'll have an assignment from MERS, which there's no such thing. There's no such thing as an assignment of mortgage, because the mortgage can't be separated from the note. I mean, that's law. I have 13 pages of statutes that you can use for that. But the point is that's a total, complete fraud to begin with.
Oh, yes. They really are dirtbags, aren't they?
Okay, hang on. Do we have anything else for you, Ed? We're about to go to break.
No, I'm done.
Okay, we are back. Randy Kelton, Deborah Stevens, Rule of Law Radio, here with Steve Skidmore, Joe Esquivel, and our special guest, Richard Cornforth. And Richard, you wanted to announce your IRS program, and Richard's going to leave us after this segment. So will you tell us about your IRS program?
Yeah, just briefly. I was challenged many years ago to come up with a strategy against the IRS. And the problem with the IRS is there's many things that are supposed to work, but they don't work because they're the guys
as with, and they come after you. So we devised a the closest thing to a fail-safe strategy to protect yourself from the IRS, and we advocate that stay under the radar if you can, but if you cannot, take it into the administrative process, and we give you the step-by-step of how to do that. And we advocate that if you do that, you can never lawfully be prosecuted by the IRS. That in itself is worth how much? $1 million? But also, using the same process, it is very, very difficult for the IRS to be able to take any money or property away from you. So I just wish people would open up to this material. And again, this is one of our modules at richardcornforth.com. But if people out there have an anxiety about the IRS, perhaps that can be set aside by subscribing to some of the materials there, because the IRS issue of the IRS confiscating people's money and property to resolve this incredible debt problem that's now very much in peril because of its interplay with the mortgage-backed security and government financing, people need to be really ramped up on IRS, and right now that the IRS is a little bit on the ropes, it's the ideal time to do that. So, again, the IRS information is available on our website at richardcornforth.com.
Okay, and Richard, I really want to thank you for being on. This has been a wonderful show, and we will look forward to your coming back again.
Well, good. Great. Great.
So, okay, thank you. And do you want to stay and answer some more questions, or do you need to go?
Yeah, I'll take a few more questions until we come up to the break.
All righty. Then now we're going to go to Charity in Iowa. Hello, Miss Charity.
Hello.
What do you have for us today?
Okay, I have a couple of questions. The first question I have is, when you challenge the jurisdiction during a trial, or, well, the jurisdiction on this particular case was challenged just before the trial started, and they clearly did not have jurisdiction, but the judge just ignored it and continued on.
He lost jurisdiction. He lost jurisdiction. There's a memorandum in our materials, and pardon me for interrupting, but this is so important for people to understand. You are never foreclosed on challenging subject matter jurisdiction, and the court must conduct a findings of facts and conclusions of law regarding your challenge, or the court has lost jurisdiction. End of story.
Okay, so if now after the fact, we didn't know what to do, so we tried to do everything we knew to do. This was actually a criminal case.
Right.
Okay.
Still the same.
Basically, it was a first-degree robbery charge, and the person who I was helping, there was no robbery. It's been on the record that the police officers lied on.
And again, I'm not interrupting, intending to be rude, but again, they had to say who did what, where did they do it, when did they do it, how did they do it, who was the victim, and what are the damages. If they left out one thing in a criminal prosecution, they lost subject matter jurisdiction. So you need to look at the charging instrument.
Okay.
It was either an information indictment or possibly a grand jury return, but there was probably better than 90% chance it was on information only. That information has to say who, what, where, when, how, statute, victim, damages. If it can't state that,
it's not there.
Then you go back
and you collaterally attack that in state court. This was a stinker. It was just a malicious prosecution. Okay?
And a little trick you might try. If you think they're pulling a fast one, go to the clerk, the district clerk, and ask for the name of the court recorder who did the recording of the grand jury hearings, and then ask the, then send a letter to the court recorder asking her to price the transcripts for the day of this indictment. We had someone on last night, did that. The court recorder came back and said there was no hearing that day. There was no recording.
Okay, let me get that written down. You said asking the court reporter to do what?
Yeah, the grand jury is generally a court reporter's bid on being the reporter for the grand juries. And then the court pays them. The best way to find out that they're pulling shenanigans is to look in their records and in the money they dispense. So you want to find out who the recorder was and ask the recorder how much she would charge you for a transcript for the day of this hearing.
Okay.
See what you get back.
And it's very important to understand it is an affidavit form. It cannot have a conclusion or an opinion. It has to have facts, period. No conclusions.
No, okay. So then purchase those transcripts from the actual day that the charging instrument was created.
Exactly.
Right, because
you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised how often there is none.
It either doesn't exist or it is the factual sufficiency of a claim.
Okay. Yeah, because this one is like no one who was there could believe that they got away with what they done. The young man that I was helping, basically what they saw him do was he was kneeling in the street. And that's all they ever seen him do. And he was charged with first-degree robbery, 20 years.
Yeah.
Okay, I have a statistic for you you're not going to like. Mm-hmm. Average conviction rate for every state that I've looked at, 99.6. You are living in the worst police state the world has ever seen. Mm-hmm. The United States contains approximately 3% of the world's population. We house approximately 50% of the world's population of inmates. Would you recognize a police state if you were in one? And I can demonstrate with specificity and particularity how every single arrest in every state I've looked at is not only wrong, it is very specifically against particular law. And it's not just against law. It's against law for a very specific purpose, and that is to put a reasonable person of ordinary prudence in a position such that they have no option but to accept a deal when it's offered.
And one thing to remember is there is no such thing as a common law crime. All crimes are statutory.
Mm-hmm.
If they can't put your finger on the statute that was violated, no crime was committed. Now, it's a little tricky because it could have been quasi-criminal, but quasi-criminal only applies to people that are operating in a system of privilege.
Okay.
There's no such thing as being convicted of being a bad person. They have to show you what statute you violated or what business enterprise you were in that imposed a criminal penalty for violating the code applying to that activity.
Okay. And then the other question I have is...
Okay, hang on. We're about to go to break. This is Randy Kelton, Steve Skidmore, Joe Esquivel, Rule of Law Radio, here with our special guest, Richard Cornforth. And Richard will be leaving us now. I really appreciate you staying with us. We'll be right back.
We really appreciate it. And we'll talk to you again soon.